Hey everyone, welcome back and thank you for being here. So this is part four in the lecture series on Jean-Luc Nancy's Of Divine Places. I've got a lot going on, and so I've got to keep recording these episodes. So there's not necessarily as much prep work as I might have preferred, or I don't have as many additional thoughts as I might have preferred for the amount of content we're going to cover. We are going to go through the entire text like usual. And yeah, I gotta get on the road in a few days and start traveling for that all the other books. So we gotta get going. I wanted to cover Snow and Dirty Rain by Richard Sykin as well. This is the final poem in Crush, and I think Meanwhile comes right before. It's You or Jeff, which is like really long and cool, and then Meanwhile, which is short and steadfast, and then Snow and Dirty Rain. And again, when we have any kind of, I guess you'd say sexual language in Sykin, it can evoke an intimacy without needing to be sexual, if that makes sense. And that the immediacy of the divine or the immediacy of the nature of being could be that intimate. And I think I'm gonna ruin the punchline, but let's go to the very last line in this poem. The last few lines. We are all just trying to be holy. My Applejack, my silent light, silent night, just mash your lips against me. We are all going forward. None of us are going back. This, like, we are all going forward. None of us are going back. Is there's this sort of commitment, this sense of being committed to, necessarily metaphysically committed to whatever happens and whatever we end up doing. We can't stop our progression through time, our march towards death. None of us, mash your lips against me. I just think it's important to say, like, that doesn't. That's not like an actual kiss. It's like the urgency of trusting yourself and trusting other people. Trusting yourself not to make mistakes and not to hurt other people and trusting people not to hurt you. Just a lot to ask for. But anyway, I think that's the way we should look at. I think that's one very reasonable way to look at the sexual language. And that being said, the entire book is about this sort of obsessive, repressed desire. Because Sykin is gay, so he's trying, I don't want to say trying, but he's processing the experiences of having that violently repressed, even within those he's engaging with, and to feel that kind of colonized violence in one's self-identity. So those are the themes at stake there. Also classic relationship stuff, like I made mistakes in the relationship and I'm sorry and it sucks. I'm thinking of Litany in which certain things are crossed out, for example. It's a really good poem. And yeah, his tone there is like, yeah. So we're gonna start with Dirty Snow and Dirty Rain, and then we'll keep going with Of Divine Places. With Of Divine Places, we were at like page 31 in the PDF, the bottom of page 135 in the book. Section 33. everything looks right with the recording. Snow and dirty rain. Close your eyes. A lover is standing too close to focus on. Leave me blurry and fall toward me with your entire body. Lie under the covers, pretending to sleep while I'm in the other room. Imagine my legs crossed, my hair combed, the shine of my boots in the slatted light. I'm thinking, my plant, his chair, the ashtray that we bought together. I'm thinking, this is where we live. When we were little, we made houses out of cardboard boxes. We can do anything. It's not because our hearts are large. They're not. It's what we struggle with. The attempt to say, come over, bring your friends. It's a potluck. I'm making pork chops. I'm making those long noodles you love so much. My dragonfly, my black-eyed fire. The knives in the kitchen are singing for blood. But we are the crossroads, my little outlaw, and this is the map of my heart. The landscape after cruelty, which is, of course, a garden, which is a tenderness, which is a room. A lover saying, hold me tight, it's getting cold. We have not touched the stars, nor are we forgiven, which brings us back to the hero's shoulders, and a gentleness that comes not from the absence of violence, but despite the abundance of it. The lawn drowned, the sky on fire, the gold light falling backward through the glass of every room. I'll give you my heart to make a place for it to happen, evidence of a love that transcends hunger. Is that too much to expect? That I would name the stars for you? That I would take you there? The splash of my tongue melting you like a sugar cube? We've read the back of the book. We know what's going to happen. The fields burned, the land destroyed, the lovers left broken in the brown dirt, and then it's gone. Makes you sad. All your friends are gone. Goodbye. Goodbye. No more tears. I would like to meet you all in heaven. But there's a litany of dreams that happens somewhere in the middle. Moonlight spilling on the bathroom floor. A page of the book where we transcend the story of our lives. Past the taco stands and record stores. Moonlight making crosses on your body and me putting my mouth on every one. We have been very brave. We have wanted to know the worst. Wanted the curtain to be lifted from our eyes. This dream going on with all of us in it. Penciling in the big-hearted slob, penciling in his outstretched arms, our Father who art in heaven, our Father who art buried in the yard. Someone is digging your grave right now. Someone is drawing a bath to wash you clean, he said. So think of the wind, so happy, so warm. It's a fairy tale, the story underneath the story, sliding down the polished halls, lightning here and gone. We make these ridiculous idols so we can pray to what's behind them. But what happens after we get up the ladder? Do we simply stare at what is horrible and forgive it? Here is the river and here is the box. And here are the monsters we put in the box to test our strength against. Here is the cake and here is the fork. And here's the desire to put it inside us. And then the question behind every question, what happens next? The way you slam your body into mine reminds me I'm alive, but monsters are always hungry, darling, and they're only a few steps behind you, finding the flaw, the poor wells, the place where we weren't stitched up quite right, the place they could almost slip right through if the skin wasn't trying to keep them out, to keep them there, on the other side of the theater where the curtain keeps rising. I crawled out the window and ran into the woods. I had to make up all the words myself, the way they taste, the way they sound in the air. I passed through the narrow gate, stumbled in, stumbled around for a while, and stumbled back out. I made this place for you, a place for you to love me. If this isn't the kingdom, then I don't know what is. So how would you catalog it? Dawn in the fields, snow and dirty rain, light brought in buckets. I was trying to describe the kingdom, but the letters kept smudging as I wrote them. The hunter's heart, the hunter's mouth. Trees and the trees and the space between the trees swimming in gold. The words frozen, The creature's frozen. The plum sauce leaking out of the bag. Explaining will get us nowhere. I was away, I don't know where, lying on the floor, pretending I was dead. I wanted to hurt you, but the victory is that I could not stomach it. We have swallowed him up, they said. It's beautiful, it really is. I had a dream about you. We were in the gold room where everyone finally gets what they want. You said, tell me about your books. Your visions made of flesh and light. And I said, this is the moon. This is the sun. Let me name the stars for you. Let me take you there. The splash of my tongue melted me like a sugar cube. We were in the gold room where everyone finally gets what they want. So I said, what do you want, sweetheart? And you said, kiss me. Here I am leaving you clues. I'm singing now while Rome burns. We are all just trying to be holy. My Applejack, my silent night, just mash your lips against me. We are all going forward. None of us are going back. Especially top half of the third page. Really like that section. All right. 33. Bottom of page 135 in John Luke Nancy. But at this point, Nancy's introduced us to a lot of his main concepts, places, monotheism versus polytheism. I just want to, I don't know if I'll have a chance. I want to do the four quartets by T.S. Eliot. But I know I don't have time to do it in this series, so it's gonna have to be its own thing. It might even be its own series. But the third quartet is called the Dry Salvages, and the beginning of that is not the best part of it. The best part of it, in my opinion, is further down about personal identity, and it's really inspiring stuff. But again, thinking about gods, one. I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god, sullen, untamed, and intractable. Patient to some degree, at first recognized as a frontier, useful, untrustworthy as a conveyor of commerce, then only a problem confronting the builder of bridges. The problem once solved, the brown god is almost forgotten by the dwellers in cities, ever, however, implacable, keeping his seasons and rages, destroyer, reminder of what men choose to forget, unhonored, unpropitiated by worshippers of the machine, but waiting, watching, and waiting. His rhythm was present in the nursery bedroom, in the rank ailanthus of the April dooryard, and the smell of grapes in the autumn table, and the evening circle in the winter gaslight. The river is within us. The sea is all about us. The sea is the land's edge also. The granite into which it reaches, the beaches where it tosses, a tense of earlier and other creation, the starfish, the horseshoe crab, the whale's backbone, the pools where it offers to our curiosity, the more delicate algae and the sea anemone. It tosses up our losses, the torn seine, the shattered lobster pot, the broken oar, and the gear of foreign dead men. The sea has many voices, many gods, and many voices. The salt is on the briar rose, the fog is in the fir trees. The sea howl and the sea yelp are different voices, often together heard. The whining in the rigging, the menace and caress of wave that breaks on water, the distant rote in the granite teeth, and the wailing warning from the approaching headland are all sea voices, and the heaving groaner rounded homewards in the seagull. And under the oppression of the silent fog, the tolling bell measures time, not our time, rung by the unhurried groundswell, a time older than the time of chronometers, older than time counted by anxious, worried women, lying awake, calculating the future, trying to unweave, unwind, unravel, and piece together the past and the future between midnight and dawn. The past is all deception, the future futureless before the morning. Watch when time stops and time is never ending, and the groundswell that is and was from the beginning clangs the bell. We're not going to do the full Dry Salvages. But fare forward, voyagers, fare forward, travelers. Fare forward, you who think that you are voyaging. You are not those who saw the harbor receding, or those who will disembark here between the hither and the farther shore. You guys should check it out. It's enough of that for now. Just need some coffee and double check the meeting. Oh, set up a little bit. All right. So hopefully also you guys are enjoying the little divergences for the first, not the majority of the video, but the first chunk of the video before we keep trudging through Nancy. But after all gods are odious. All sacrality is oppressive, either through terror or through guilt. As for separating the divine from the sacred altogether, is it possible without yet again nullifying the divine? All sacrifice is a traffic in victims and indulgences. Christ's sacrifice sums it all up, mankind redeemed as if it were a band of slaves at the cost of the most precious blood. How can anyone have sought to argue that Christianity was a non-sacrificial religion? Because it is a religion, it is sacrificial. And because it represents faith in a God, it is a religion. The gods are odious to the extent that they saturate the universe and exhaust mankind. That extent is no doubt always measured by religion as such. And religion, whatever we try to make words mean, religion and the sacred remain the measure of the divine. The God who deserted religion would no longer be a God. Levinas, among others, knows this. He even speaks of atheism, but it is an atheism of God. There is no getting around the fact. I skipped a section. We're going to go back. And I'm probably not going to reread what I just read. So, we're right here. We'll finish that paragraph. Yeah, sorry guys. Bottom of 134, page or section 32. Just as former materialists or former freethinkers began intoning the mumbo jumbo, had a no trace of a return of the spiritual. Theologians were getting down to reading the scriptures and understanding the message of faith in terms of all the codes of the sciences of this world: semiology, psychoanalysis, linguistics, sociology, and so on. General anthropology was called upon with the sole end of converting the word of God into human speech so that men might better grasp its divine import. Over and above the manifest contradictoriness of this strange logic, there is something curiously aberrant here, as if God let himself be understood, as if he made himself understood. In the time of the scriptures, God did not make himself understood. He showed himself, his word obliged. There was no question, even when the doctors were interpreting, of knowledge or of understanding. It is high time we learned that no scripture can be of any help to us, be it through a decoded message or a mystery held in reserve. The book is no longer. I am not saying there is no longer a book, for there is undeniably, to the same extent that there is divine service in every temple, church, synagogue, or mosque. But I am saying that the book is no longer, as we ought to know, since Mallarmé and Joyce, Blanchot and Derrida. It is not in vain that the text was proliferated, has become scattered and fragmented in all our writings. The writing we practice, which obligates us and is infinite to us, is in no way the alpha bong of Scripture. Scripture, on the contrary, is undone and swept away in it, without end, without God, definitively without God or His Word, toward nowhere except this carrying away and this disaster and this fervor bereft of faith and piety. Writing and its trace lie outside of Holy Scripture along its outer edge, which they contribute endlessly to fraying and breaking down. The age when the book was placed on the altar and read is past and gone. Writing will no longer speak of the divine. So there are singers, I think that's what they're called, in Sikhism, and they will cover it later in the semester. And they explicitly only say what's in the book. Islam doesn't edit their texts. The book is finished, and it's not, it can't be reorganized, and it's kind of scattered intentionally because it's supposed to be more organic to how it was revealed to Muhammad. But I think the Sikhs had like 10 gurus that it was passed down through. And so they kept, and the 10th one organized it all, but didn't add any of his own writings. And they keep their book, I think, on a pedestal in their like church or whatever it's called. So anyway, I think he could have considered them. Like, it's like the main thing they do. Anyway, writing will no longer speak of the divine. It no longer speaks of anything but its own insistence, which is neither human nor divine. It inscribes the undone edges of books, altars, and readings. It inscribes the disjoining of their religions. It traces a divesting of the divine, the denuding of the gods that no word announces. Face to face, but without seeing each other from now on, the gods and men are abandoned to writing. This abandonment is the sign given to us for our history yet to come. It has only just begun. My God, we are only just beginning to write. Maybe I did read that last time. Sorry if I did. I thought I went back and checked. I don't think I did. After all, the gods are odious, sacrifices to traffic and victims and indulgences. All right, middle of the next paragraph. Second paragraph in 33. The god keeps an eye, an ear, a hand on everything he holds or pronounces, the Alpha and the Omega. He accounts for everything, and in the end, we must give account of everything to him. Stop. When Winchester licks his skin too much in certain areas, he gets rashes or hot spots or irritated. He rubs it raw. Anyway, gods prevent the supreme undecidedness of man. They close off his humanity and prevent him from becoming unhinged, from measuring up to the incommensurable. In the end, God sets the measure. The gods forbid that man should be risked further than man. And most serious of all, they take away his death. That is to say, they take away his sacrifice, this time in the sense of his abandonment. I'm not sure if this is the first time we get abandonment in the text. I don't think it is, but it could be. For there is an abandonment that is not a traffic, but that is an offering, an oblation, a libation. There is that, a generosity, and a freedom outside of religion. However, I am not sure whether this abandonment is still to gods, to another god said to be coming, or to no god. But it has death as its generic name and an infinite number of forms and occasions throughout our lives. No doubt this abandonment has always forged a path for itself through the religions. In the end, though, these religions have failed to allow it to be accomplished. They have irresistibly diverted it and misappropriated it. Not modern religions only, but all religions, all forms of worship, all rites. What there is to say here can be said very simply. Religious experience is exhausted. It is an immense exhaustion. This fact is in no way altered by the upsurge in the political, sociological, cultural success of religions. Islam in Africa, the Catholic Church in Poland, or from another angle in South America, Protestantism in the United States, Jewish, Islamic, or Christian fundamentalism, sects, theosophies, gnoses. There is no return of the religious. This is 1986. There are the contortions and the turgescence of its exhaustion. Whether that exhaustion is making way for another concern for the gods, for their wandering or their infinite disappearance, or else for no god, that is another matter. It is another question altogether, and it is not something that can be grasped between the pincers of the religious, nor indeed between those of atheism. No God. This would be or will be unrelated to atheism, at least to that metaphysical atheism that is the counterpart of theism, and that wants to put something in the place of the God that has been denied or refuted. No God. That would mean God's place really wide open and vacant and abandoned, the divine infinitely undone and scattered. It could equally be the God so close that we can no longer see him, not because he has disappeared inside us, but on the contrary, because in coming closer and disappearing the closer he comes, he has made all our inside, all subjectivity disappear with him. He would be so close that he would not be either before us or in us. He would be the absolute closeness to ourselves, at once tormenting and glorious, of a naked presence, stripped of all subjectivity, a presence that is no longer in any way a self-presence, neither the self-presence of a consciousness, nor the presence to that consciousness and its science of representations of self-world God, but a naked presence, less the presence of something or of someone than presence itself as such. But presence itself as such does not constitute a subject. It does not constitute a substance, and that is why no God. The accomplishment of the divine would be no God's presence. So this is 19 years after Voice and Phenomenon, which is a critique of the metaphysics of presence. I think it's a good response to it, because he's discussing the displacement of presence as presence, because there is still presence. There's still some phenomenal experience that we have, and it is divine and can be divine or was divine at one point. But without something, someone, and without the formal concepts or the science of consciousness's science of present of its representations. Okay. To return to the problem, this would not be a dialectic of death and resurrection. It does not lie by way of a death of subjectivity, which for Hegel is precisely the definition of death, and more particularly of the death of Christ, in which death is defined as the very moment at which the subject is constituted, discovering itself, and accomplishing itself in the suppression of its particularity. Say that again. In which death is defined as the very moment at which the subject is constituted, discovering itself, and accomplishing itself in the suppression of its particularity. God, in this sense, has always signified the very idea of the subject, the death of death, truth and life in the suppression of existence, and a singular exposure in the world in the suppression of place and instant. The presence of no God would be what thinking on the subject has never been able to approach. And even though it was only ever separated therefrom by an infinitesimal distance, indeed an intimate distance, it would be death that is not the aufhebung of life, but its suspension. Life suspended at each instant, hic et nunc, suspended in its exposure to things, to others, to itself. Existence as the presence of no subject, but the presence to an entire world. An invisible presence everywhere offered self-same with being there, self-same with the there of being, irrefutable and naked, like the brilliance of the sun on the sea, millions of scattered places. Very lovely picture of dislocated presence. Give me one second, guys. All right, sorry about that. So dislocated presence, dislocated places. This presence of no God could, however, carry with it the enticement, the call, the wink of an adieu, of going to God or an adieu to all gods. And adieu also means goodbye, right? It's a going to that is a goodbye. Together, inextricably, divine presence and the absence of all gods. The place, hic et nunc, again, in place of the gods. Perhaps that was written between the lines of the very principle of ontotheology. Deus interior intimo meo. There is a place more remote than the place of any subject, a place without substance consisting entirely of exposed presence, sheer invisible presence, brilliance, eclat, where the subject God flies into pieces, eclats. 34. I would like that one. There is a place more remote than the place of any subject, a place without substance consisting entirely of exposed presence, sheer invisible brilliance, where the subject God flies into pieces. Brilliances, I guess. 34. Why Christianity? That is to say, why did Hellenistic Judaism, given Roman form, have to engender that new era by which we once lived? In a sense, nothing new came of it, apart from a new configuration for a Western world already at least 10 centuries or so old. St. Paul drains from the language of Hellenistic mystery religions, a language impregnated at the same time with philosophy and dating back to Egypt, the thin trickle of water from one or two marginal Jewish baptisms, and offers it in the imperious style of Roman activism to a world given over totally to morals. I mean morals here in Hegel's sense, the reign of Verstellung, of a ceaseless shifting between the pragmatic density of the here below and the transparence of values and wills in the beyond. I think it's really cool that he uses the word transparency here. I first saw that word in Against Interpretation by Susan Sontag, which is also, it's 20 years before he's writing this. So transparency in Against Interpretation is the how it is that breaks forth to create like a sui generis form of the artwork. So it's something that is unique to itself, is different, but is exactly what it ought to be or should be, and it makes sense what it ought to be or should be. So it gets its normative weight, it gets its aesthetic quality, its sense of beauty, its ability to produce beauty in others. It gets that by its self-contained, usually self-contained or self-apparent cohesion. And that it's transparently as it is, how it is. who it is. Okay. I also therefore mean it in Nietzsche's sense, ressentiment against this world, which is like when you can't. I don't know all the full details of ressentiment very well, but I think it involves like a sort of paranoid narcissism where you make other people be bad or you imagine them to be worse than they are as a way of accounting for your own failures or one's own failures, the perceiver who is who perceives the world more resentfully. Servility, the organization of weakness, and in addition, work, technology, subjectivity, the modern state, which will all nevertheless still have been, to use Heidegger's terms, missives from being. Morals did not come from Christianity. Christianity, on the contrary, originated in them. They are neither religious nor philosophical. So, this is an interesting discussion on morals. In philosophy, morals are a forgetting of thought, and in religion, they are a forgetting of the divine. Morals are Socratic thought without Plato, and Socratic thought is the impiety of Greece without art. What was new was merely the Ordo Romanus, which tended both to be a religion on its own, not to say an absolute religion, and to dissolve in itself all religion, which provided morals with a frame. In that sense, Christianity was the empire depoliticized and rendered moral, which is also to say unburdened of strictly Roman sacrality. And it was morals rendered imperial, that is, preserved from the adventures that they had, after all, been through from the Cynics to the Epicureans and perhaps down to the Essenes. But what then was radically new was the twilight of the gods and morals, the opening out of humanism and atheism, and the simultaneous invention of theodicy, considered as the general matrix of modern historical thinking, of technology, or of politics. Theodicy can only emerge when the god is in decline and finds himself tangled up, as he declines, in the affairs of the world. It is then that he must be justified, shown to be provident and considerate, because the ways of the world and its affairs must be justified. Theodicy is thinking about meaning and the guarantee of meaning. In this thinking, it engulfs the gods. Theodicy, that is to say, anthropodicy and logodicy, is the truth of Christianity, of that religion that abolishes all religions in itself. Having completed the task of making the gods odious, it consists in providing the meaning of morals by means of a morals of meaning. God is resolved into a justified history, the history of a subject, history itself as subject, and the ultimate justification of this history lies with man coming everywhere onto the scene in place of the gods. He is the last species of odious God, the man God himself abandoned by God, the totally secular divinity of humanity in its arrogant forcefulness, in hoc signo vinces, and in its complacent effusions, the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Something else was offered simultaneously, however. It was a prayer. Quote, "Let us pray to God to deliver us and free us from God." Meister Eckhart. This marked the return in the modern guise of dialectical thinking of the old ordeal of the religion of the God who abandons, the religion that the Western world looks upon as that of the Jewish people, the people whom, quote, God had kept aside to be the age-old anguish of the world, end quote, and that, quote, was destined to witness the agony, end quote, of the end of the world of the gods, and that's Hegel. With the Judeo-Christian religion, moral assurance and anguish at the passing of the gods progressed side by side. So moral assurance and anguish at the passing of the gods. Our atheism will turn out to have been inextricably woven from these two strands, morals that dissolve the gods and prayer to God to be abandoned by him. If we are to pass beyond our atheism one day, it will be because we no longer even pray to God to deliver us from God. Number 35. However, Christian faith, not to say Christianity, but it is advisable not to have too much faith in that sort of distinction, expose something else again, a thing apart, Christ. That is to say, something to be confused neither with the personage whose moral preaching is told of in the Gospels, nor with the sublime or bland figure exploited by centuries of piety. Set apart from the doctrine of the Gospels and from the exploits, Jesus, and the exploits of Jesus, Christic theology propounds the mystery of the man-God. This mystery corresponds to the fact that the essence, or the instance, or the presence of the man-God is neither the fruit nor the product of any process, of any operation. It is not a union, and strictly speaking, the term incarnation is not appropriate to it. The strict canon of Catholic faith lays down that in Christ, quote, the two natures are not united solely by homonymy, nor by grace, nor by relation, nor by interpenetration, nor by naming alone, nor by worship, nor by the conversion of one nature into the other, but through subsistence. There is only one hypostasis for the two natures of man and the God. There is neither fusion nor differentiation, but a single place of subsistence or presence, a place where the God appears entirely in man and man appears entirely in God. This is neither a divinization of man nor a humanization of God. What there is this: how man appears to the God in the God, how the God appears to man in man, and how that itself is totally unapparent. In this unapparent appearing, faith and theology, and in theology, thought, somewhere link up, while religion and philosophy, and in philosophy, theology, turn obstinately away from this point. At least, that is what one might be tempted to say. But this opposition is too simple and vain. What the mystery of Christ borders on, that is to say, what all divine mystery has eventually bordered on from whatever religion we extracted henceforth, this point of the naked appearing, parousion, or the dislodging of man before God and of the God before man, this point of their immediacy can no longer be preserved as if it belonged to an order of faith distinct from an order of reason and of institution. On the contrary, this is what we must affirm. With the gods, faith too has disappeared. That is, our truth, and against it, the evidence of the heart and inward conviction are powerless. For faith, as long as it is faith, belongs neither to the inwardness nor to the feelings of the faithful. Faith is entirely an outward act of presence, of the order of presence and of manifestation, because it is or was faith in God. It is or was like clearly turning one's face toward the manifest heavens. There is no faith in a vanished God. As he withdrew, he took faith with him. For faith had never addressed itself to darkness, but solely to the radiance of the divine. What henceforth puts us face to face with the no return of the gods cannot be a faith, nor even, nor especially, a faith in the mystery of this no return, or this no God. Faith is faith in mystery, which is God made evident. Along with the God and with faith, mystery has withdrawn. There is no more mysterious revelation, no more mystical revelation, not even the soberest, most reserved sort, the sort most given up to its own darkness or its own unapparentness. There is, in a way, a zero mystery inscribed in the margins of holy books, on temple courts, at the close of the prayers of those who still meditate before the mystery, inscribed also on our artificial suns and moons in our calculations, and always self-same with the heavens. This is much more and much less than a death of the gods or their absence or their withdrawal. It is something else again, something totally different. Zero mystery means no mystery and the mystery of there being none. And always it is a matter of the appearing of the God to man and of man before the God. This dual appearing is without mystery. Everything has been explained. One has only to read the essence of Christianity or the future of an illusion. And it is not worthy of thought to look down, as is very near to happening, upon such arguments, for the gods that these arguments laid to rest or denounced had themselves long since become unworthy of thought and of faith. One is only to read De Rerum Natura It is the poem of clarity wrested from mystery, which promptly plunges into insignificant obscurity. But there is a mystery, a zero mystery, about this very clarity, about this peak of clarity regarding the nature of the things among which and to which our existences appear. It is a zero mystery. There is nothing to seek nor to believe, no God, but it is a mystery. This closeness of things, this manifest world, is precisely what conceals itself. 36. In the end, something resists. To all of the harshest and most justified criticism of Christianity, of its political and moral despotism, its hatred of reason as much as of the body, its institutional frenzy, or its pietistic subjectivism, its traffic in good works and intentions, and ultimately its monopolization and its privatization of the divine. To all of that, maybe commodification too. To all of that, something puts up a resistance beneath the horizon of everything, something that it is not impossible to claim has, in spite of all the mumbo jumbo, left upon the form of the Paternoster, that prayer which Valery in his unbelief judged to be perfect, a mark that is difficult totally to erase. A generous abandonment to divine generosity, a supplication out of that distress to which the divine alone can abandon us, the divine or its withdrawal. No doubt something in us resists that resistance. The title Father appears suspect to us. We see only too well what this God is modeled on, but perhaps we see very badly. Perhaps the Father, for those who made up this prayer and for those who prayed it, was not something paternal on the lines of our petty family affairs. Perhaps paternity was nothing more, but also nothing less than the obscure evidence of a naming. However, in the end, beyond the end, if necessary, we can yet but say, the Paternoster is finished, in Latin as well as in all languages, for we speak another language than its language of prayer. We speak another language, one whose names, proper and common, profane and sacred, have yet, in a still unheard of sense, to be sanctified. 37. To strive against idolatry presupposes that one has the highest and most demanding idea of God, or of the absence of all gods. That is precisely what shows up in the limits, what shows up the limits of criticism of idols. For in opposition to the idol, there is no idea we can form of God, nor of his absence, apart from a moral or metaphysical idea, which in essence has nothing to do either with the gods or their presence. I am not proposing a return to idols. In any case, there is nothing to be proposed. I would merely posit that idols are only idols with regard to the idea. But above and beyond idol and idea, in the effacement of every god, be he old or new, it could be that we see emerge, like an idea imprinted upon an idol, serene and secret, the unmoving smile of the gods. All right, smile of the gods is the next big step we take from the wink to trying to think about the face of the god, self-same. The man god is right, the place is there. Place is a way we can think about self-same and simultaneity. Their smile would be there on their clearly delineated lips. They would not be idols. They would not be representations. But the outline of divine place would be in the smile of their face, a face effaced but exposed, here or there present, offered, open, and barred across, withdrawn by that same smile. This place of the gods has no place, though there are archaic statues that suggest that it does. But it is not just anywhere. It is delimited by the smile of the gods, that thinnest tightening of their lips, which do not even part. In that singular feature, the smile of the gods, a feature as singular as a stroke of the pen, there is this. Where the god presents himself, he withholds his divine name and his divine knowledge. But this withholding appears in his smile as an idea imprinted on an idol. Idea and idol undo each other infinitely. All that remains is their speechless, smiling, ideal, and divine exchange. 38. The gods whose life is naught but joy, quote unquote, from Homer. We too once had a word or a shout for that. Alleluia. Henceforth, our joy and the thought of our joy will keep themselves more secret. But when what concerns us is the gods or no gods, then we are concerned with nothing else but joy. 39. A dual temptation is constantly recurring, either to baptize with the name of God all the obscure confines of our experience or our thought, or on the contrary, to denounce such baptism as superstitious metaphor. For as long as the Western world has existed, perhaps not a single argument concerning God has avoided yielding to one or other of these temptations, or even to both at once. But God is not a manner of speaking and of protecting ourselves, nor is he the ultimate truth of reality. Nor is he the ultimate truth of humankind. Men and women are men and women, and the gods are the gods. They are distinct and can never mix. Living in the same world, they are always face to face with each other, on either side of a dividing and a retreating line. They are, together, the vis-a-vis itself, the face-to-face encounter in which the unreserved appearing of one to the other engages with them in an irredeemable strangeness. The gesture of the gods is to conceal themselves on this very line from the face of men. The gesture of men is to stand back from this line where it encounters the face of the god. They thus have no names for each other. For the gods, man is unnameable, for there are no names in the language of the gods. It knows only the summons, the order, the expression of joy. And the name of God, among men, names only the lack of sacred names. But men and the gods find themselves brought together face to face in this way, unnameable and perhaps absolutely intolerable to each other. 40. God is for the community. The gods are always the gods of the community. And a community in return is what it is only before the face of the gods. Quote, finite consciousness only knows God to the extent that God knows himself in it. Hence, God is spirit, and more precisely, he is the spirit of his community. That is to say, of those who honor him, Hegel. If there are no more gods, there is no more community. That is why community has been capable of becoming horrifying, massive, destructive of its members and itself. A society burned at the stake by its church, its myth, or its spirit. Such is the fate of community without God. It thinks it is God, thinks it is the devastating presence of God, because it is no longer placed facing him and his absolute remoteness. But it cannot be brought face to face with its vanished gods. That's a new concept. Wandering gods, vanished gods, face to face, brought before the face of, facing on the face of. And all of those facing terms being self-same, amem. The less so in that it is with the withdrawal of the gods that community came into being. A group of men facing its gods does not conceive of itself as a community. That is to say, it does not seek within itself the presence of what binds it together, but experiences itself as this particular group, family, people, tribe, before the face of the God who holds and preserves in his innermost self the truth and the power of its bond. So that one, I guess the main argument there is that you can't find community in the name of community. You can only find community as the byproduct of something more organic, like a devotion to a God. That is why we should not say that God is for the community. Community as such indicates that the gods have taken their leave. We should say rather that the God is always for several people together, including when he is my God. As soon as I name my God, or as soon as I am summoned and appear before him, I find myself precisely thereby placed alongside other mortals like me, which is not to say that they are always those of my tribe or my people. This is why we can also understand cogito ergo sum, the I think therefore I am, the recognition of the cogito in our minds. We should think of that as divine access, and we should think of that as announcing the cogito of other people's minds as well. We should therefore rather lead community toward this disappearance of the gods, which founds it and divides it from itself. Over divided communities, self-same with its expanse, like a sort of ground plan. The traces of the paths along which the gods withdrew mark out the partition of community. With these traces, community inscribes the absence of its communion, which is the absence of the representation of a divine presence at the heart of community and as community itself. Communion is thus the representation of what the gods have never been, when they were or when they are present, but what we imagine to ourselves when we know they are no longer present. In place of communion, in fact, there is the absence of the gods, and the exposure of each of us to the other. We are exposed to each other in the same way as we could together be exposed to the gods. It is the same mode of presence without the presence of the gods. This is what I said before. So if we have these religious experiences where we make supplications and address my God, and it turns out there is no my God, or that the gods are not there, it is the same mode of presence without the presence of the gods. In place of communion, there is no place, no site, no temple or altar for community. Exposure takes place everywhere in all places, for it is the exposure of all and of each in his solitude to not being alone, the exposure to not being alone. This is not only or necessarily take place at the level of families, tribes, or peoples. On the contrary, these, as we know, can all circumscribe solitude. But on the contrary, because in our great metropolises, where more and more different communities exist side by side, intersect, pass each other by, and intermingle, the exposure to not being alone, the risk of face-to-face encounter, is constantly becoming more diverse and more unpredictable. Before whom, at this precise moment, am I writing? Before what Arabs, what blacks, what Vietnamese, and in the presence or the absence of which other gods? Not to be alone, that is divine. But I shall not say that is the divine. That would be another baptism. For the God is never alone. He is always presenting himself to the other gods or to mortals. Solitude only has meaning and existence for mankind, not for the God. He is always addressing himself, assigning himself, sending himself, or else, and it is the same thing. He is being invoked or encountered or worshipped. How are we not alone when we are neither before the gods nor within the bosom of the community? That is what we have to learn through a community without communion and a face-to-face encounter with no divine countenance. So the next section is too long to cover before we run out of time before the hour mark. So we're going to cut it here. We'll start in the middle of page 144. We have got, I think 6.5 pages basically, plus footnotes. So definitely going to wrap it in the next episode. We'll do a few more poems. We won't do dry salvages. We'll do winter recipes from the collective, I believe, although I may not screen share it. I'll try to put it together and host it. So yeah, thanks for being here, and I'll have more resources and more food for thought for you soon. So I appreciate your engagement, and hope you are enjoying this work. And if you're in one of my actual classes, then yeah, I hope you're in the exam for this wouldn't be too bad. You'd have a lot of freedom with how to approach presenting the text. So all right, I'll see you soon, and we'll be in touch if you're one of my students. Take care. See you guys.